great Jehovah God who rules in the kingdoms of men, who does whatever He wills and no one can ask why, who sets above the nations of the earth even the lowest of men, and who in our own lives humbles us when we rise in pride. We offer You praise. We offer You thanksgiving. We declare Your justice in all that You do, whether it's in our favor or as we perceive it not. Father, we continue to ask for the things that we need, our daily bread, and beyond that, the things that we need that we do not know we need. Pray that You would guide our lives through what we perceive as tragedy, and more importantly and more dangerously, what we perceive as success. We ask this prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, let's do the quiz. I hope these are getting to be easy and trivial. That's the idea. What are the first captives, the date of the first captives? You're going to have to say loud. I've discovered Wednesday, I'm not hearing very well up here. I'm going to pop my ears and see if that helps. Okay. Yeah, 605. See, I heard that. Second set of captives taken to Babylon. 597, fall of Jerusalem. 586, okay, all right. And then finally, the fall of Babylon. Okay, 539, and of course that's when the descendants of Nebuchadnezzar are no longer in rule. Okay, this is a different question here. There are three chapters, actually there are three pairs of chapters. I didn't word that very well, but anyway. Two chapters that have a vision or dream about the four kingdoms. There are two chapters in Daniel that have a dream or a vision, however you view it. What would that be? You know one because we've studied it just recently. Chapter 2 for sure. What's the other one? No, it's not 4. Four has a dream. It's about a kingdom, but not about four kingdoms. 7. I saw Adam mouthing the words, but he knew it. It's two chapters about kings being humbled.
4.
That's good. That's today. And what else? And 5 is the other. Now, these are two kings. What are differences about that? I'll forget to come back to this, and I wanted to maybe highlight a few differences. They're both humble. They're both proud, right? And in both cases, there's a dream, and or at least some revelation from God, I guess, the handwriting on the wall. But something needs to be interpreted, I guess I should say. What are differences between 4 and 5? Now, we're not to 5 yet, so you know you get a pass if you... Yeah, it's a good kind of a happy ending, to, so to speak, and that is he comes to his senses and he's restored actually to power. Whereas in chapter 5, we're going to see that very night Belshazzar dies, and that's the end of the Babylonian dynasty, so to speak. What other differences? Maybe we'll wait and ask that again next time. What are two chapters about kings? Sorry, I did that. Two chapters about God's faithful people being delivered. No idea? I mean, I already said 3, so that didn't hear. Okay. The 4 metals, we can do these quickly. What are they? Gold, silver, bronze, iron and clay represents Babylon, Medo-Persian, Greek, Hellenistic, and Roman. Okay, so that's good. What is the theme of the book? Actually, it's in this chapter about 5 times. God rules in the kingdoms of men. So whether that's said out loud or not, it's illustrated by these visions or by the events of the chapter. What is the primary image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 4? What's the primary image? It's a giant tree, thank you, and it fills the whole earth. There are 3 miracles in Daniel. 3 miracles, not counting miraculous dream recall and interpretation and all those other things. Not counting that. What are they? Fiery furnace, we've already seen that.
Lion's den.
Lion's den, and what's the 3rd? Writing on the wall. Okay, so those, and we will see those are referred to as signs. In fact, we'll see that in the lesson today. All right, for bonus, in the bonus round here, what are the Hebrew names of the 4 friends? First one's easy. Daniel, good, very good. So, what are they? Hananiah. Mishael, which is the closest to Meshach, right? And Azariah. That's good. So Daniel, remember, that's the Hebrew name. And that kind of comes up in this story where Nebuchadnezzar is calling out Daniel, and he actually calls him by his Hebrew name and kind of almost, you might think, confesses that, but I'm the one that changed his name. So why would he do that? It's interesting the way he said that. All right, remember, we're in the Babylonian captivity, which is after the United Kingdom, after the divided kingdom, and so now there's this 70-year period, which was promised by what prophet? 70 years, the period of time. What prophet? Jeremiah, which would represent the extent of Nebuchadnezzar's domination as well as the period of time that they're in captivity in Babylon, which there's a reason for that, because Cyrus is the one that released them. So we talked about these dates already, three periods of captivity. Which one did Daniel go in? First, all right, and then Ezekiel in the second. And you see that this period of the Babylonian reign goes on down to Belshazzar, the last one, probably the great-grandson or something like that of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, I think, reigned for 37 years, quite a while, really, if you figure in that time, how long people actually reigned in that rough-and-tumble political environment. And then, of course, Cyrus the Great came along. We were looking at the chapters, and we saw Daniel 1 actually describes them being taken captive in the very initial days of their training. Remember that? So we kind of know exactly when that is. Daniel 2 is probably very close, maybe 3 years, the way the thing reads, from that period of time where Nebuchadnezzar is looking for somebody to interpret a dream, and guess who's there? I meant to point this out a couple of times. There are so many other stories that are a little bit like this, but not the same in different ways. Can you think of another person who was in the king's palace who could interpret dreams? That'd be Joseph, yeah. Anybody else that lived in a king's palace and had to teach the king a lesson and all that? Moses is in that. So there are a lot of similarities, and it's interesting to think about all those. Anyway, 1 and 2 is pretty clearly near the beginning. Chapter 3 we saw last time. We don't know when that was, but if you kind of think about the fact that Nebuchadnezzar is awful proud and ready to set up a god that he wants worshipped, that's his god, and you know he's going to, what does he always do? Tear you limb from limb and your house become a dunghill. But he's going to do that if you don't. He's in a kind of a prideful state then, right? Perhaps he's fired up after some of his victories. So that, I think that's probably the case. In this chapter, chapter 4, what's his state politically, that kind of thing? Something might help us date the book a little bit. Is there anything in the chapter that would indicate where we are in that 37 years of reign? You know what I'm talking about, this blue line right here. What would you say? Right, that's right. He's at a time of relative peace. In fact, the very word, I think, is I'm in the green, or I'm in the green leaves or something. The idea is that he's flourishing and healthy and things are going well, at peace and so on. And what else is indicated maybe in this story about where he is in his reign? And I'll give you a hint. It's 12 months later after the first story. Where is he at that point? You remember where he is after 12 months, after the dream and the warning and all that? Somebody knows. He's in Babylon, that's right, but where in Babylon in particular? Actually tells us where he is. Yeah, he's on his palace. Now, the word roof is interpolated, but he's up on top of his palace, which suggests there's quite a view from there. And he looks out across the city and he says, is this not the great Babylon? So he's looking at quite a few buildings that he must have built. And so he was famous for building projects. Danny was telling me that Danny had been looking into what does the secular world know about Nebuchadnezzar. And the answer is not much, except that he was a great builder and he won a bunch of battles, right? What we know of his personality, we know from the Bible account, Daniel's account, which I think is actually more accurate, probably. But still, he was a famous builder. Well, this is far along in his building project. So all that to say, we're probably somewhere farther down, right, where he's near the end. But not at the end, remember, because he's restored and reigns for a while after that. Okay, going on, 5 and 6 clearly is right at the end of the Babylonian, the beginning of the Persian. Daniel 7 comes back again, the vision again, and so on. Just a point I would make is you notice the blue font in these things. What's interesting about that, the blue chapters 2, verse 4 through chapter 7? They're Hebrew. You might have thought that the reset, the backspace, so to speak, in the chapters chronologically would have come at the end of that, but it doesn't. It actually continues on in Aramaic and goes backward in time. To me, that's interesting because there are a lot of folks who say, well, this part of the history was written in one language by some one person or another. These are linked together. The language doesn't seem to separate the theme. In fact, I wanted to go ahead and remind you of this chart. You remember there are three chapters which are kind of the core visions that tell us kind of the sweeping picture of history to come, starting now and on into really down to the time of Christ and the destruction of Jerusalem. 2, 7, and 9. We already know 2 is a statue. What's 7? You remember? These are the core. We call them cycles in a way. 7, what's 7? Oh, we should have done the chapter quiz maybe. Or maybe everybody knows. But you. What's 7? You remember? No, it's not the lion's den. Yeah, I think there's a lion in it though. There's a lion, right? A bear, a leopard, and then something terrible, ugly. Doesn't even say what it's like. There's just too many weird things about it. So then the chapter 9, and then of course in every case there's something grand and wonderful. One is the Son of Man coming to the Ancient of Days in chapter 7. And then in chapter 9, what's the kind of core image that gives us this whole sweeping picture of history? I know the prayer is first, and almost in answer to that prayer, really, in a way, which is forgive us, restore us, and then God answers with the vision of what? What's that? 70 weeks. Yeah, I really want to make sure we learn this. 8 has the ram and the he-goat, which is just more detail about that second and third kingdom. 70 weeks doesn't so much distinguish between all four, but then if you go on into 10, there's this grand, shiny picture of a person introing the story. There's three more kings, which really seem to probably center on the kind of the Syrian area or those kings in the Greek rule with Ptolemies and Seleucids that are fighting each other. And then a vile person, which might be Roman, but it might be Antiochus Epiphanes in the Greek period. And then an evil king, which might be Roman. And then finally, the time of trouble and time of the end, which seems to correspond to Matthew's account when Jesus said, this is what Daniel was talking about, this destruction of Jerusalem. So I know this is a little bit boring, but if you could just learn 2, 7, and 9, that would be helpful, right? Statue, beasts, and 70 weeks. That's not hard. That's what's in those chapters because they kind of give the sweeping picture, and then after each one, there's a smaller section of time covered. Can you do that? Is that okay, I thought about putting that on the quiz, but I decided not to. All right, chapter 4. My excuse for reviewing so much is I think you know what's in chapter 4. It's one of the stories we've studied a lot, but I do think these larger this larger framework for the book will be helpful, especially as we get on into those later chapters. All right, Nebuchadnezzar's introduction. This is my outline. I think you come up with a better one. The magicians fail to interpret the dream. That doesn't take very long. And actually, we don't hear the dream, but it's clear that Nebuchadnezzar shared that with the magicians, but they couldn't interpret it. Nebuchadnezzar tells the dream to Daniel, 9 through 18. And I don't know this for sure, but it seems as if that maybe Daniel didn't know the dream until Nebuchadnezzar began to tell it to him. But it also seems clear that as Nebuchadnezzar tells him the dream, God's revealing what it really means. When he gets done telling him the dream, Daniel just sits there kind of saying, I don't want to deal with this. It's almost like so either he knew in advance, or maybe I think more likely God was telling him what all this means. And then there's a gap in time. In fact, the voice of Daniel takes over in verse 28. We'll talk about whose voice is going on in the rest of the chapter. But then it's fulfilled a year later. And then finally in the last few verses, Nebuchadnezzar repents and restores. Have you read the text? You know how that stands? We might read some of it. It's a little repetitive because the dream gets told more than once, right? In fact, when Daniel interprets it, he says what the dream is. And then he kind of says some things about what it means. And then so on, so some repetitive. But let's begin chapter 4, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. So who's speaking? Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah. So did he write this, or does it matter? Maybe Daniel wrote it down. Maybe some of the scribes wrote it down. But it certainly is the voice of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, I think it's typical, and you'll see this all through the Psalms, the poetry in the Old Testament. And there is often a switching between addressing God, you know, in the second person, you've done this, and then all of a sudden it talks about God. And I think that's true in this story too. It'll go back and forth. But you know, as a royal we, you can talk about yourself and still be talking yourself. Okay. And then in verse 3, he says, "How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. His dominion is from generation to generation." So, you know, so can you, have you got that words of verse 3 in your mind a little bit? Look at this psalm, Psalm 145. "All your works shall praise you, O Lord, and your saints shall bless you. They shall speak of the glory of your kingdom and talk of your power, to make known to the sons of men his mighty acts and the glorious majesty of his kingdom. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and your dominion endures throughout all generations." Does that sound familiar? So where did Nebuchadnezzar get this little poem here in this introduction, I wonder? Yeah, I think we have this idea that Nebuchadnezzar lives in one half of the palace and Daniel's off somewhere else, only calls him when he has a bad dream, right? Where is Daniel in the kingdom here? Yeah, he's been promoted about three times. He's second in command. You kind of have an idea they might have a little bit of a rapport, right? Maybe that explains his absence in chapter 3. Maybe he was on business, or maybe he wasn't required to be out there with all the common rulers, right? The sheriffs and everything that were out there. I don't know. I shouldn't have said that. Stephen asked the hard question, but anyway. Daniel wasn't there, but maybe because he was second in command. That wasn't his deal. He didn't have to do that. Don't know. But he was close enough that he might have shared that with Nebuchadnezzar. You think so? And the other thing that it says is his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. His dominion is from generation to generation. What? Nebuchadnezzar is saying this? Where would he get this idea of an everlasting kingdom that lasts forever? Where would Nebuchadnezzar have heard anything about that? Besides the psalm, if he knew the psalm that Daniel had shared with him. His friends maybe might have been part of it, Cherry? Yeah, that's what the first dream was about. Remember the rock that came out of the mountain? What was the rock turn out to be? It was an everlasting kingdom, right? And he was impressed that Daniel could tell him the dream. So he remembered that. These are the words almost that come from really chapter 2. So I kind of see in this thing the influence of Daniel's teaching. I'm stretching perhaps, but certainly his memory of Daniel interpreting a dream, even though it probably was 20 or more years before, 25, 30 years before when that happened. Yeah, Grant? Yep, 34. Yeah, that's good. I wanted to actually think about that the whole class period. So I'm laying that problem. Thanks for articulating the question. I'll warn you that I don't know the answer for sure. I'll come back to you at the end and you can tell us what the answer is. But you see what his question is about, what he's saying here. How far did Nebuchadnezzar really go? And by the way, is Nebuchadnezzar writing these first three verses? He probably didn't think he was writing verses, but was he writing this introduction before or after these events in the chapter occurred, do you think? Yeah, so I think if we're going to look at the evolution of Nebuchadnezzar, this is not how he was feeling going into the story. This is how it was after he got done. Because he says, "I'm going to tell you about some signs that have happened in my life." Right? So if we're going to put a chronology together, we have to do that. But Grant's point's a good one. Over in 34, you get a similar kind of thing. His dominion is an everlasting dominion. He's talking about God. His kingdom is from generation to generation. You'll notice he's actually more extensive and more exhaustive about this. "The inhabitants are as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven. Among the inhabitants of the earth, no one can restrain his hand or say to him, 'What have you done?'" So these are lessons that he has learned, and in the form of actually a song of praise, perhaps. They're in chapter 7, verse 27, and in 6, 26, you'll find similar expressions as well. But these are from Nebuchadnezzar, okay? And I think, in fact, keep that in mind for as we go through, if I manage the time right. Verse 35, "He does according to his will in the arm." First he says, "The inhabitants of the earth are as nothing, reputed as nothing." He does according to his will where? In the host of heaven. You mean there's another realm in which stuff might be going on? How did Nebuchadnezzar know about that? So keep that question in your head as we kind of go through. All right. Here's the tribe of the magicians. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts on my bed and the visions in my head troubled me. Therefore, I issued a decree to bring all in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, soothsayers, we've seen these guys before. In fact, it seemed like, I wonder why he's even kept them on staff, but they must have some other value, I don't know. And I told them the dream. But they did not make known to me the interpretation, all right? So before Stephen or somebody else starts asking the questions we don't know the answers to, so here's the first one we don't know the answer to, but I'd like to talk about it because I think it helps us kind of think through the text. Under the condition that nobody's going to go out of here saying Marty said this was the answer or something like that, right? Because I don't know. But I think it helps to think about it, right? Isn't there an obvious question here? I mean, haven't we been through this before, right? So what's going on? Why does he bring all these guys in? Well, now, wait a minute. I don't know about that. The chapter 2 thing, he was the head of gold. And it would kind of look pretty good, you know. He was kind of happy with that. I mean, I guess unless he really believed those fellows that would say, oh, king, live forever, I think he probably knew that there would be, you know, into his dynasty. And, hey, whatever happens later, I don't... Yeah. So... Okay, maybe he's still reluctant to accept that. Although, man, after the fiery furnace, I think I might have... In fact, I might have, like, not even gotten out of bed till I started screaming for Daniel to come on in here, you know, after a bad dream at night, but... yeah, Ron. So I think from the standpoint of literary value, again, we're again seeing man can't do it and God can, right? That's very clear. That's the message here, just as it was in chapter 2. They couldn't do it. Even under threat of death, they couldn't figure out how to tell him the dream. In that case, tell him the dream, which, by the way, that's the second hard question. We'll get to that in a minute. Yeah, there's... Yep. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah, so maybe that's a good... I was hoping people would come up, so... Yeah, he's throwing them a softball this time, isn't he? Hey, I'm going to help you out. Couldn't do it last time, give you a crutch. Here's an easy pitch. See if you can hit this one, right? Yeah, Lindsay. Ah, interesting. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, multiple voices. Let's see what happens. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, he clearly has not given up some idea of that. Yeah. Yeah. Steve? Yeah. This is the way the things work, right? Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Although his title, you notice what Daniel's title is when he finally brings him in? What does he call him? The chief of the magicians, right? But it could be that this ought to be a gimme, so why don't we bring the head guy in to start with? I don't know. Maybe he'd weeded some of those guys out over the 30 years or more. But yeah, Nathan? I'm sorry. Yep, Steve. Right. They spent all day looking at the guts of animals and stuff, but no, they might have actually, it's a very good point. They probably did have, and that's why I say he might have weeded out the nutcases, and what he was left with was decent advisors who could suggest some things. He was a pretty clever guy, Nebuchadnezzar. Hey, guys, come on in. Yeah, right, right. This is your job. It's actually not Daniel's job. That's one thing I think about. Yeah, Daniel had a lot of other things to do. Perhaps maybe this is easy. Yeah, Ryan. Yeah. Yeah, right. In English, there's some implication of finally, you know. But I think it's kind of like at last, or, you know, after all this is kind of probably the implication. But yeah, it's like give them a try and then, boy, okay, let's go back to Daniel. So here, too, another difference in chapter 2, is Daniel like, did he say, I need a night to think about this? And there's a whole lot of like to-ing and fro-ing. Are you sure you can do it? Oh, yeah, but God is the only one that can reveal it. No, actually, Nebuchadnezzar says that about Daniel. He doesn't have to say about himself. So it's a pretty, I would say, a lot less formal thing where Daniel finally comes in and tells him the interpretation. Mine says in verse 8, but at last. But I think the idea is that, you know, kind of let's make an end of the story. Daniel finally came in. Now, remember Nebuchadnezzar's talking, and I'm going to skip down to verse 7. Let's answer that question. The magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream, but they could not make known the interpretation. We have to go faster. We're not going to get to my application, same as always. But why did he tell them the dream this time? Didn't he learn? He was actually real clever last time. More questions we don't know the answers to, but I think it helps us evaluate the facts of the story. Was this dream as hard to interpret as the other one? A statue made of different metals and all that, and a rock out of a mountain not cut out with hands and destroys the whole thing. And this one, what? Yeah, maybe it's on the earth, yeah, something. Right. I wish we could read the dream. I'm not going to take time to do it, but the story's not quite as bizarre in a way. Not only that, the tree, if you notice, look at verse 14, chop down the tree and cut off its branches and strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. And I almost picture that the animals scatter too. There's an interesting picture there, right? Things underneath, you know, the birds go like that, and then all the animals underneath go scurrying away. But then in verse 15, suddenly, bind it, the brutes, that is, with the band of iron and bronze and the tender grass. And then what? Let it be wet with the dew of heaven and let him graze. Now wait, something happened there. There's a switch. What happened in that verse right there? Now, by the way, this is Nebuchadnezzar telling the dream. This isn't the interpretation. Wouldn't you kind of easily conclude that? So I'm thinking I'm one of these magicians. I don't have a clue, but he tells me the whole dream. Oh, great Nebuchadnezzar, live forever. The tree is a man. You know, and I'm thinking, oh, great, you're doing good. So it doesn't seem like they could do a little bit better at making something up. There's an interesting thing about this dream, a little bit to cut to the bottom line here, and that is, do you need to know all the details of what it means to know what the purpose of this revelation, this dream was, what it really meant, what it was supposed to teach people? You have to look at the text to answer this question. Do I need to know who the tree is? Do I need to know what the animals are? Do I need to know what the iron and bronze bands on the root are to understand what the dream was supposed to tell us? The dream tells you. That's kind of the cool thing. Look at what it says. And in fact, in talking, it's like, the decision, verse 17, is by the decree of the watchers. I believe that's kind of Nebuchadnezzar's description. And the sentence by the word of the holy ones, what? In order that Nebuchadnezzar might know, that royal people might know, that smart people might know, religious people might know. No, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets it over the lowest of men. You understand that you don't even have to know what the dream meant. That's what it's supposed to be teaching you. Do you all understand that? So here are the soothsayers. Why can they just repeat that? I don't know. But I have an idea that they maybe just didn't want to. Not only that, who is this about? Who is this dream about, as it turns out? Nebuchadnezzar is telling them the dream. Who is it about? What's his name? I'm going to say Murdoch. That's not it. What's his name? What? The Babylonian god? Why? Anyway. Marduk, thank you. Murdoch. And Bel, you know, after whom Belteshazzar's name. It's not about him. It's about the Most High. And I'm one of these magicians, and Nebuchadnezzar says, here's the dream. I don't know what it means, but here's what the guy in the dream told me it meant. It's about the Most High God. And I'm thinking, pass. Right? I don't really care to talk about that. Not only that, isn't it pretty clear that it's not good news for Nebuchadnezzar or somebody, whoever that is? Most likely Nebuchadnezzar. Pass. I don't know. Sorry, King. But apparently he's out of the mode where he, you know, tears you limb from limb and your house becomes a dunghill. He's out of that mode, so to speak. Maybe he's mellowed in the latter part of his reign, but they pass. And I think part of the reason is just because it was maybe too easy to tell what it meant. And it was about the Most High God, and it was not great news, and it was about proud people. Not that there were any in the room at the time, right? So anyway, so that's kind of an interesting point. So back to the outline here. Yes. I think it's the kingdom of men. He rules in the kingdom of men. That's for all mankind. I think he's saying a little bit like, in fact, I actually put it, I'll never find the chart, but Acts 17, you know, God made of one flesh all nations of the earth and determined their appointed the bounds of their habitation, right? I just think he just sets the world up. And thinking of all men as the realm of men, he gives it to whomever he wants to. I think that's the point. Okay, so that's it. And so Daniel begins then to explain the dream. And the way he does it is he repeats the dream, more or less word for word. A little bit of embellishment, a little bit of change and so on. But in even verse 23, inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down, and so on. But then he says, verse 24, this is the interpretation of that watcher, for example. He says, this is the decree of whom? The Most High, which has come upon my Lord the King. So it turns out the watcher, whoever that was, the word probably means a guard, a military person who might be a bodyguard or standing watch at the gate or something, but somebody who's watching over things. Now here's a point where we might just come back to what I mentioned earlier. And that is Nebuchadnezzar actually seeing things that are not even in the physical world now with this watcher? I think it's maybe an angel. We're going to see angels later. In fact, this kind of dream in some ways can't think of the word I'm trying to think of. It's a preview, right, of some of the dreams that come later. And I hope we'll have time at the end to say, what do we learn about interpretation from this dream? But Nebuchadnezzar's giving a little peek into the world. There's watchers. There's watchers of his kingdom who come in and they do what God tells them to do. They say what God wants them to say, and they execute God's will in His kingdom. Is that really true? Is there a spirit world that where people are good and evil are kind of wrestling and they're watching over us and God makes sure things happen the way they're supposed to in that realm? Do you see how Nebuchadnezzar's gotten a little peephole again into this non-physical world that represents somebody who's watching over him and taking care of him? And I think that's what the watcher perhaps might represent. And so, back to verse 34, one of the things he learns was he does according to his will, what? In the army of heaven. So there's a kind of a peek into the supernatural world. Okay, so Daniel tells him that, but what's the real interpretation? There is a part of the dream that has to be interpreted, right? And so it says, where is that? Verse 24, it says, this is the interpretation, verse 25, here we go. They shall drive you from men, your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, they'll make you eat grass like ox, they shall wet with the dew of heaven, seven times shall pass over you, till you know. Okay, here's what this is about. It's about you realizing something. Now, I just will quickly say, does this indicate a different relationship between Daniel maybe from the first story and this story? You have somebody in your life that will point the finger right in your face and say, listen, you better learn a lesson from this. And they're still your friend after they do it, right? In fact, when he's telling the dream, you can almost see Daniel's face drop and say, I don't want to tell him what this means. And so he waited so long to say anything. Nebuchadnezzar said, look, say it. Just say it. It's okay. Say it. And so he did. And he didn't just stop by saying, this bad thing is going to happen to you, right? He went on to say, you need to repent. In fact, maybe if you repent, it won't be as bad as this is saying it's going to be. You understand? He's pretty strong with Nebuchadnezzar here in terms of changing his life and not being so proud and taking care of those who are at a disadvantage. And I think the connection there is Nebuchadnezzar was rich. He'd built all this stuff with his own hand, his own power. And he talks about his brightness and his majesty, and everybody came to him for advice. Man, he was on top of the world. And you tend to think when that happens that everybody else that isn't on top of the world is what? Well, they're just not as great as me. They weren't as smart. That's got to be it. They're not as bright, right? They're not as strong. They're not as clever. Is that really what happened? Or does God set whomever He wants to over the nations of men even the lowest. Hint, hint. Right? So, inching into the applications, I think when are we the most vulnerable to this kind of a problem is when things are going well. I was thinking about this yesterday. I was raking leaves and thinking, why do I have this yard with all these leaves? But I remember when I bought my first dwelling, and I actually owned it. It was a 12 by 60, 25-year-old mobile home. They're also known as trailers. And I can remember walking through that thing thinking, behold the mighty Babylon, you know. And, you know, and I had a little bit of Goodwill furniture, and that was it. But, you know, have you ever had that feeling? I graduated from high school. And somehow we think we're on top of it because of this accomplishment. You know, it's a vulnerability we have when things are going well at some whatever relative level we're living at, you know. And anyway, so there's that. So then Daniel seems to come in. Verse 28 says, all this came upon the king, but not right away. How long did it take? A year. I think maybe, I'm making this up, mute the tape here, that he tried for a little bit to do better. You think? Is that possible? I mean, these dreams troubled him. You know, Daniel was forthright. Daniel had not been a liar. Daniel's the one person maybe he could trust. Maybe he tried. But a whole year later, there he is on top of the palace. And what does he say? And Daniel has to report this, by the way. Is this not the great Babylon I have built for a royal dwelling by my power, my majesty, blah, blah, blah. And it's almost like maybe this voice from heaven, Neb, you know, something like that. And he goes, whoops, too late. So then he's struck, and so he has this mental disease. I would just say about the mental disease, it does not seem to have impaired his ability to have a conscience and think hard and repent and understand that God is kind of in control and that he'd been doing wrong. And as soon as he had that realization, in whatever state of eating the grass he was, God fixed it, just like the promise, just like the dream had said. I want to come back to the seven times. How long is that? Till seven times. It's mentioned maybe three different times. First time in verse 16 when Nebuchadnezzar is telling the dream. This is the watcher talking, right? Let him be given the heart of an animal, which suggests, that really, word literally means that innermost organ, the heart, but it means a mind, right? It means this is the spirit you're going to have. But he says, let him graze with the beasts, wet with the dew of heaven, and let seven times pass over him, right? What do you think that means? It's not the word for years, so don't say that. It could mean 7 years, but the word isn't years. It's more like the word seasons and periods of time. It actually says in the text how long it is, if you look carefully. And that is, if you look at the latter part of 25 and also in the latter part of 32, it is until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. You see that? This seven times is some period of time, maybe days, maybe weeks, months, maybe years, whatever. But I'll tell you how long it is. It's exactly as long as it takes Nebuchadnezzar to realize what he needs to realize. Remember that about our prophecies coming forward. We'll have times, times, and half a time, right? Starting in chapter 7. How long is that? I don't know. Maybe it's half as long as it takes to realize. I don't know. But it's some period of time that's determined more by the events at the beginning and the end than it is some tick of the clock in between. Does that make sense? It's a long enough time for something to happen. I think that's the point of that. Okay, then, so Nebuchadnezzar repents and is restored. We've spent some time with the psalm and so on. He ends by saying, I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth, his ways are justice. Justice? What has he done to this poor man for seven times? Is that just? Is that what he's saying? I think he is. Yep. Yeah. I wonder if in our pride, when we're brought low by an event we cannot control, maybe it's we think of it as loss of money or something, but maybe we go nuts for a while. Maybe we have an addiction. Maybe there's something that just takes us out of ourself for a long time we finally come to. Do we think that was just? That was fair. Thanks. I needed that. You know. Could have been worse. Could say that. In what way it could have been worse is that he wasn't apparently taking out a rule. which in those days you went nuts. I would think there would be enough enemies. In fact, Daniel says, this dream is really kind of in favor of your enemies. The word, let this be to your enemies, is interpolated, really. It's not there. It could mean, I hope this happens to your enemies. It probably means, this is going to be something that favors your enemies. But I think that his staff, whoever they were, thought enough of his rule. And maybe for political reasons, it was not a convenient thing to announce that Nebuchadnezzar had flipped. Right? How's Fidel Castro doing, by the way? Yeah, he's great. I guess he's working every day, right? 8-10 hours a day at his computer terminal, right? Do you understand there's some political advantage in not saying what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, right? So he may have been propped up. Maybe that's why history doesn't record much about that. Okay, we've answered all these questions. Why didn't the magicians make up something? How long is 7 times? And then, I want to end with this. Here's some hints on interpreting dreams. If you have a dream that's from God, you know it. There's no mistaking about it. There's several things. One is it will trouble you to death. Second, it might happen over and over. And third, it kind of doesn't rest till you figure out what it means. Nebuchadnezzar knew this was from God. He may have had other dreams, but this one in chapter 2, it's pretty clear. So the idea that you have a kind of a vague dream or a feeling, that is not God speaking to you. You know it. 7 times, we talked about what that means. It's a period of time. What does the band of iron and bronze mean? Remember that? Cut down the tree, put this band around the roots. Cinch it tight. I made that part up, but what's... Okay, one idea is it so it can regrow. Another idea is it so it can't regrow. There's 2 models of that. Either way, the answer is we don't know. Is it possible that some of these visions, we don't actually know what the details mean? Why do we not know? He hadn't told us. It's that easy. There are details we don't know. We can speculate. Sometimes it adds to the picture, but we don't really know what that's about. And verse 34 is interesting. The end of the times, verse 34. At the end of the time, or the, actually literally days, does that mean it's the end of the world, the judgment day? Is that what it's talking about? It's the end of the sevens, when it was right to be over. What was right to be over? Nebuchadnezzar's madness. It's not the judgment day. It's not the destruction of Jerusalem. How do you know what the end of the times are here? It's just what the story's about, right? And I'm just saying we've got to be careful. We'll see the last days, end of times. Let's be careful. We don't always assume it's a judgment day. There's a glimpse into the spirit world. You already kind of saw that, right? Where he could see, well, something's going on here in the other world. There's a watcher who comes down and says that things ought to happen, and then it happens in the real world, right? In my kingdom, which is like a tree, and the peoples and others that I care for, which are like the birds and the animals and so on. So there's a watcher, there are armies of heaven, verse 35. And the other thing, this is key to me, and that is, can we actually apply a vision like Revelation without actually knowing what the interpretation is? Is that possible? Do you see that in this text? Yeah, we know what this is about. In the end, I may not know exactly each day of my life how this, I don't know which king this is and which king. But I'll tell you, I know what the dream means. It means God rules in the nations of men. And I ought to think that every day when I watch these silly elections, debates like we had last night, or I watch the terrorists in France or whatever. What do I keep thinking? I don't know what all the iron bands are and all that, but I know God rules in the nations of men. Right. That's kind of the message. And I think we can see that in Revelation. Occasionally there's just a pretty clear statement that all the kingdoms of the earth, that even... It even says Jesus rules the nations with a rod of iron. That was in the Old Testament. It's in Revelation 3 or 4 times. So that's the message. Now, what all the details are, I don't really know. Right? But I think that's what we can learn. So these are some hints on interpreting visions and dreams. Right? And that is, you know it's a dream when it happens. Times can mean till it's necessary. We don't know what all the visions mean. Ends of times is determined by context. There's a spirit world going on, which, by the way, we can never see, really. And then finally, we can apply things without actually knowing all the meaning and the interpretation. All right, that's it. I hope you have next lesson.